KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. I'm honored to have my guest filmmaker Nina Minkus here today. There's going to be a retrospective of her work in New York and Los Angeles, L.A. through March 7th, New York March 9th through the 16th, at the Anthology Film Archives in New York, My Neighborhood, and UCLA Film Archives, at the UCLA Film and Television Archive, the Billy Wilder Theater, when it's here through March 7th. First of all, Nina, I was telling you before we got started, I really do think of you in that group of select filmmakers who are instinctive filmmakers. I said before, Wong Kar-wai and George Miller and Antonioni, people who think through the camera. And I'm guessing it's that sort of thing where, because you started just shooting very young and working as a photographer, I even sort of think there's that kind of weird sort of intersection between someone like Robert Capa and directors in your work. Would you agree with that?
I came to photography. I started doing photography when I was a teenager, still photography, and I was also a dancer. And then I thought I was going to be a dancer, and I was living with some people in a house. Anyways, it's not that interesting of a story, but I ended up making a dance film. And that was my first experience of like movement, and I kind of like got so excited about photography and movement and composition, and so I always like came from that place of intuition as opposed to place of storytelling, dialogue.
And I wonder if you agree that it's a real emotional narrative,
yeah,
rather than that kind of ABC storytelling. I mean, one of my
exactly.
favorite films of yours is The Great Sadness of Sahara, which I really feel like, I said to you before we got started, is like this subconscious version of a David Lean movie.
Oh my God, no one could say anything better than that to me. I'm going to just cry.
Well, give the audience, it's going to be one of the films that's going to be in the retrospective. Give them a little taste of what they're going to see with The Great Sadness of Sahara.
Okay. Great Sadness of Sahara was the first 16mm film I made with my sister Tinka, who was sort of my partner and muse for many years. She's a genius on many levels. And I had this idea that it would be a film about a stranger in a strange land, a white woman in the third world, and a spiritual quest, which usually is guys going on spiritual quests. So here's this girl, and she, you know, we were both super young.
And she looks like a kid, but there's this kind of, but you photograph her as this sort of iconic figure, but
yeah.
There's this real excitement in her eyes about being there.
Yeah. Yeah. She is sort of definitely a kid, but she's also such an old soul. I think you can feel that in her body, you know. She's like carrying all this almost deep pain from God knows what, you know, maybe the Jewish pain of 10,000 years or whatever. Anyway, so she's.
But that's funny you say that, because there is that sort of thing in all the films about people looking for a place to land.
Yes.
Looking for a settlement. That's the current that runs through everything you've done.
That's so true. Well, I think exile in general is huge thing for me, you know, physical exile, interior exile, and ultimately exile. It's being cut off from God, you know, whatever you want to call God, you know, your own higher power. I mean, I'm not religious in a conventional sense, but being disconnected from your spiritual center is, and wanting it. I think that's the core of every single one of my films.
It's so much that, because I've seen that term sort of journey, but I feel like it's not really a journey so much as just trying to find a place to settle, really.
That's
as much
totally,
as anything
totally
is.
Precise. That's totally precise. And that feeling of home, you know, can home be a place that's safe? I think that's you know, all the characters are in danger or under threat of danger, you know, and imminent danger, imminent threat.
It's The Treatment. My guess is the incredible filmmaker Nina Menkes is a retrospective of her work in L.A. at the Billy Wilder Theater, UCLA, through March 7th. It picks up at the Anthology Film Archives, March 9th through 16th. Walk us through the story of how dissolution comes to be, how you work it out, how you decide to shoot. Do you shoot in a kind of a, what you feel is sort of the order the film is going to be cut together or what? I think people would like to know that.
Every film has been kind of different. Okay. Certain films I had very specific scripts that I go, you know, like literally follow the script very precisely. And other films I had no script, like The Great Sadness of Zahar that you mentioned had a very rough outline, you know, stranger in a strange land, white woman in the third world, you know, looking for God. And that was it, you know. And then The Bloody Child had no script at all. I just want the arrest of this man, you know, in 29 Palms. That's a whole other.
Well, we can get that too. And we can also say that another sort of thing that runs your films is that kind of imminent threat of the authorities or the police, or there are sirens, like sort of somewhere in the distance in all of the movies.
That's true. Well, it's this threat. It's like this threat on the edge. I think the threat is on the edge of the frame, if it's not right inside the frame. You know, some people have said my films are about violence, but it's they're very endangered. Like what you were saying before, it's like where's home? Where's safety? You know, where's safety? Which is, of course, a huge issue for Israel and the Jews, obviously, the whole history of that. And my family's actually from Israel originally, and I speak Hebrew. I grew up here. But the story of dissolution was I was in Israel for a year. I was invited to teach over there, teach film at Tel Aviv University. And I was living in the Arab area of Tel Aviv, mixed area of Tel Aviv, which is Yafo. And I came across, I mean, by chance, I don't believe the word chance, but I happened to start reading Crime and Punishment when I was there. And I read it, and I'm like, oh, my God, you know, there's something in this story that's so perfect. I didn't even, because like you said, I'm really work totally intuitively, totally emotionally. I didn't really think it out, you know, what does this mean, what does that mean? But it felt so resonant, the story. And meanwhile, I had this neighbor who was slinking around, David Fire, who ended up to, I asked him if he would be the character, because he just like was like, he seemed so perfect, you know. He's a musician, and he's not really an actor.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because funny, because he's so great, and this is a thing, too, we can talk about for people to go see the movies, they'll enjoy hearing this, too, that silence, how the silence can be like oppressive.
Yes.
Is so key. Oh, to the way you make films.
Thank you for understanding so deep. It's really such an honor to be on this show. No one can see me, but I'm crying that I'm so happy to be here.
I'm going to be crying myself in a second. The weeping voice you hear across from me is director Nina Menkes. There's a retrospective of her work at UCLA at the Billy Wilder Theater, February 18th through March 7th in New York at the Anthology Film Archives, March 9th through the 16th. But In Dissolution, which is your most recent film, I guess, what, 2010, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of weird because there's a moment where he goes with the types of meat he can get. He ends up getting lungs, which for those of us in America, unless you come from the South like I do, I mean, well, I remember seeing the film with a friend who went, who eats lungs? And just seeing him play with it, and then later he's cooking the food. It's almost this like this Dostoevskian version of Polanski's Repulsion at a certain point.
That's wild.
Can you remember that part? She's with a rabbit, which is another thing for Americans. It's kind of tough to get. And that was an obvious choice that you use to sort of show who he is and how distant he is from everybody else, that food choice.
Right. And also that he has no money because it's the cheapest thing in the store.
Oh, 10 shekels. I mean, and he only has seven.
And he only has seven. So he's like, yeah. And, you know, it's funny. Somebody, I can't remember who, someone saw that film at one point and said, you know, I'm glad you're doing this because a lot of people think, you know, Jews are rich. You know, and I'm like, okay, you know. You know, there are Israelis who count their pennies, you know. So I'm happy to break a stereotype on that level.
But also you break the stereotype or you show what other archetypes there are by putting them in this place that, in effect, is kind of this sort of
bustling intermix of people and cultural identity and ethnic identity and religious identity always being questioned there.
Yes, yes. Like, you know, there's a scene where there's an Arab girl who's stabbed by her boyfriend, and he's standing there, and the main character is an Israeli Jew, and the Arabs in the neighborhood come and are kind of threatening to him. That was a scene that the actor himself suggested because that had happened to him, in fact, in the neighborhood. So there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of tension between, obviously, you know, at the Arabs and the Jews, and just in the neighborhood, a lot of it's kind of almost under the surface, but sometimes it erupts, you know, here and there in these little incidents. I didn't feel it so much as a woman. But the Israeli Jewish men often feel it pretty strong.
It's so interesting because the silence in that film is almost like he's keeping quiet so he doesn't give himself away to anybody, even when he's by himself.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a fascinating thing, the way quiet is used there. Where does that come from for you, that kind of fascination with sound?
I'm not sure where it comes from, but, you know, like I was saying before, you know, I started off as a dancer, so I always had this idea of, you know, image and movement and sound, you know, as where I'm coming from, as opposed to like a, you know, like I said before, like, you know, dialogue and story on that level was not really my thing. And sound, you know, the sound worlds of the films, I mean, I think there's two basic strategies, you might say, that I can see in my work sound-wise. Is one is, like you said, like very silent, very, very kind of the real sounds of the neighborhood. Like in Dissolution, we collected a lot of the real sounds of the neighborhood, and then it's all reconstructed, you know? It's all carefully reconstructed, but it's all the real sounds of the neighborhood, put into a collage. Or the, like, really surreal sounds, you know, like in the Bloody Child or in The Great Sadness of Zahara, which is, like, the inner psychic world of the character starts to appear in the sound world, you know? And it might be interesting for people to know, like, I shoot my own films. I edit picture and I edit sound, and I love, you know, editing sound. It's like my absolute favorite thing on earth. It's so fun.
When did you first? I mean, you talk about not using dialogue as an indicator, but the idea of sound. I mean, did you see movies as a kid that did that to you as well, or was it just basically you're inventing this form for yourself as you went along?
I mean, I don't want to sound arrogant, but I do feel that I invented my own world. I did not see much as a kid, and I didn't have a TV growing up, which probably explains everything. You know, my mom was like, I don't like that thing, you know. So I never watched TV, and I think that kind of saved me in a way from having to unlearn, you know. And so I was just expressing myself in a very direct way, and intuitively through sound and image, and kind of just finding my own forms, you know. I think especially, you know, the films through The Bloody Child, and then, you know, Phantom Love and Dissolution in a way. Well, Phantom Love in a way is a little more classical.
And those are the last two of the films.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a break. We'll come back. My guest is director Nina Menkes. There are retrospectives of her work in Los Angeles and New York and L.A. through March 7th at the Billy Wilder Theater at UCLA, March 9th through 16th at Anthology Film Archives. It's a treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
I'm Jenny Rattlett, producer of The Treatment. If you like our show, you might also like The Business, KCRW's show about the business of show business, hosted by Kim Masters of The Hollywood Reporter. Find it on iTunes or on KCRW's smartphone apps.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest is the gifted filmmaker Nina Menkes. There are two retrospectives of her work, one on each coast, the West Coast here in Los Angeles, through March 7th at the Billy Wilder Theater at UCLA Film Archives. In New York at Anthology Film Archives, March 9th through 16th on 2nd Street and 2nd Avenue. I know exactly where it is. But the other thing I want to talk to you about, too, is that I always find it fascinating for somebody like you because the work offers up so much and it's so immersive that by getting into it, you can kind of make it what you want it to be. And reading all these kind of these sort of gender-specific philosophical interpretations where people try to place all these things on your shoulders, and you're always so gracious about it. But I think they missed, first of all, the real filmmaking excitement in the movies. You know, I mean, that to me, that kind of pops off the screen, this love of filmmaking. Aww. And it seems like, I don't want to do this, but an enormous disservice to not see that.
You know, it's just my deepest love and my way of life. You know, there's this beautiful quote by Henri Cartier-Bresson, the great photographer. He says something like, taking photographs is having your eyes, mind, and heart on a single axis. And it's not a way of trying to prove oneself, but just a way of life. Or something. I don't know, bad rendition of the quote. But some inherent thing in the way that I can experience the world cinematically. It's just my core way to access truth, you know. And I do it so much better accessing truth, you know, in my movies than in my normal life even. You know, I can get kind of sidetracked and not have that clarity, you know, that cinematic clarity.
Is it because you organize your thoughts? I think as you're talking, I couldn't help but think about Massacre. I mean, this incredible, completely emotional documentary that doesn't work in any kind of sort of conventional narrative terms. And in fact, it's almost like you came up with it to thwart expectations about what a documentary should be. Tell the listeners a little bit what the film is.
Okay, I can talk about Massacre, but I want to clarify that's not like my film the way the others are. Because, you know, I shot it, I co-directed it. I was not involved in editing. And,
oh, no.
And other people, there were other co-directors with me. It
right.
wasn't my core idea, so I have to clarify that's not like my movie the way the other ones are, but I think I brought a lot of myself to that. In
it feels like it. Do you not see that?
Oh yeah, I do.
Okay.
I just wanted to credit where credit is due. I was asked to participate by this woman, Monica Borgman, who was really her baby.
And I think this must come from you. It's again an emotional narrative rather than just being this sort of straightforward piece of old-fashioned documentary storytelling. I don't want to call it experimental because that I think that conjures up a whole kind of playing with the medium that you don't do.
Yes.
Because these things, you're not trying to sort of make these films formal or anti-formal. I feel like you're
precise.
Creating a grammar for yourself.
That's so, so true. And I do kind of always a little cringe at the experimental label because it doesn't feel right. But Massacre was a terrifying experience. I was in Lebanon shooting it's a documentary about the Sabra and Shatila massacre, if people know that. In 1982, there was a massacre of the Palestinians by the Christian phalangist Lebanese soldiers who were in cahoots with Israelis. And anyway, that's a whole huge discussion. But the film itself is an interview with six of the actual Christian phalangist murderers about their experience. And shooting it was totally freaky, you know. I mean, because it was the original idea was kind of to do something really in depth on each one, you know, like I wanted it to be like an 8-hour movie where each guy gets an hour, so you get really into him. But I didn't get involved in the editing on that film. And now the way the final form is, it's very intercut. It jumps between the different murderers, so you end up with this just experience of the horror of violence, like a seven-headed you know, snake or something, you know, that monster nightmare.
That's the film to which I think the word violent actually applies,
right?
Unlike your other films.
Yes, correct. And, you know, it is not my film all the way. And that would explain certain points.
I'm explaining, or having points explained to me by my guest director, Nina Menkes. There's a retrospective of her work in Los Angeles at the Billy Wilder Theater at UCLA through March 7th, March 9th through 16th in Anthology Film Archives. We should talk, since you were sort of alluding to a little bit about Phantom Love, which is, I love the title because it sounds like a German expressionist film from the 30s, and it's almost photograph-like one in some ways,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, definitely.
It's really elegant and sinuous, and there's and I wanted people pointed this out to you before. You have a kind of preoccupation of people going through doorways. There's a lot of doorway entrances in your movies.
That's true.
It feels like this almost pays tribute to these entrances that are key to the movies. I mean, you talked about dance, and dancers make entrances. And you give, especially the women in your film, you give them entrances.
Well, I think that, you know, going through doors, down stairways, up stairways, into, you know, it's really, it feels like an inner labyrinth. So there, you know, there are these crossing boundaries, always, you know, going into another level or a deeper level or turning a corner and down the stairs or up the stairs. You know, I saw the Surrealist show at LACMA, and I was really moved by a lot of those paintings. I felt really more akin to that work than anything in a long time, you know. And you notice there's a lot of, like, stairways and doorways, and, you know, it's like the experience of, first of all, border crossing, I think you talked about it before, like home. Where is home? You know, is it here? And no, I'm never home, and I'm always crossing borders and crossing thresholds and going downstairs or going upstairs and going through these doors and, you know, searching. But of course, I love the German expressionist, and I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah, tell me about how you cast, because your sister is not in this one.
Right.
Even though it's about sisters and
right. This
kind of interesting sort of schism between sisters and one being sort of physically whole and the other not being physically whole.
Yeah.
But at least sort of having that family of the enormous dogs in the house with her and the other being completely sort of by herself.
Right.
And how did you cast those women in those roles?
What it was is my original idea was to have a casino in Koreatown, downtown L.A., Koreatown.
Right.
Of course, casinos are actually not allowed in L.A.
L.A. They're
illegal, so that would have been a fantasy. But by the way, I'll just digress and say that, you know, I do have a certain, I guess, obsession with casinos, with the Queen of Diamonds. And then it came back in Phantom Love.
Yeah.
It sort of refers actually back to my own film. That numbers and counting are connected to death. She has this whole interior of the casino, so which is also true about Queen of Diamonds, which is a place outside of time, and it's like numbers, but trapped. So it's a vision of hell, really. Anyway, I totally lost track of the question.
Well, I'll remind people, it's The Treatment. My guest is Nina Menkes, the master filmmaker. There's a retrospective of her work in Los Angeles at the Billy Wilder Theater at UCLA through March 7th, March 9th through 16th at Anthology Film Archives in New York. But I was asking how you cast the women.
Oh, how I cast.
In
so
in
I had
Phantom
the idea.
Love.
I had the idea that I would have an Asian woman to be the star. Because after The Bloody Child, I made films with my sister for something like 15 years, and then that kind of fell apart for various reasons, mainly her physical health. She became very ill with lupus. Yeah. Anyway, so our particular, you know, partnership kind of ended, and it took me a long time to kind of feel ready to photograph someone else after that, 1996 Phantom, The Bloody Child. And so I had the idea of an Asian woman. You know, I guess I'm looking for someone who's in some way an outsider, you know, an outsider to the mainstream experience. So I thought an Asian woman. I'll have an Asian woman be the main character, and it'll be Koreatown in L.A. So it's sort of this place that's not, you know, somehow marginal. And I auditioned a few Asian women, and I realized that that I just didn't have that feeling of body double with them that I had with my sister. It just somehow, not that they weren't great actresses, but it somehow I needed that body double experience.
And these two women, should say, so similar physically, for a moment, you almost think it's the same actress playing the part.
Oh, yeah? Yeah? Oh, that's cool. That's cool. I've heard that before. And, you know, it's funny because they're not similar physically, actually, but I think people feel that they are.
Well, they kind of both have long frames. You're aware of the shoulders.
Yeah,
you're aware of the jawline
true.
Above. The way you shoot them, it's kind of tricky.
Yeah.
You're sort of playing with that. And even though they don't sound similar because the accents, rather the speaking rhythms aren't that similar, but there's a heaviness in both of the voices. So you almost sort of think they sound alike, and then you realize they don't kind of look alike at all. There's some physical damage to one. The way you play with things is really kind of fun.
Well, I ended up taking the lead girl, Marina Scheif. I found her she's an Israeli from Russia. And so she immigrated from Russia with her family when she was a young girl, when she was 16, and she went to Israel, and I knew her from there.
Okay.
And I decided, because she was a Jew, and she felt like she could be my body double, so to speak, and here she has a heavy Russian accent. So it's a family of immigrants, you know. And then Juliette Marquis did an incredible job playing the sister who's, you know, descending into madness, is also from a Russian family. She came here, I think, I'm not sure, when she was like 9 or 10. So they're both, actually Russian was their mother tongue. And then I put them, here in the middle of this Asian casino. So it's very, like, psychedelic, you know. It's like the Russian immigrant in the Asian casino, which is, you know, kind of a fantasy because there is no such thing. And then teleporting to India and... psychic continuity.
Well, before we got you to ask, you were telling me before we got started, too, that one of your films is being restored by the Academy.
I would love to thank Mark Toscano over at the Academy Film Archives for his incredible support. They're actually restoring my very first film, Soft Warrior, that I made with Tinka, my first film, very beloved to me. And they're striking new prints of The Great Sadness of Zahara and Magdalene of Uraga. So people will be seeing brand new prints.
Thank you so much, Nina.
Oh, I'm beyond honored, Elvis, really.
As am I. My guest is director, filmmaker Nina Menkes. There's a retrospective of her work in Los Angeles through March 7th at the Billy Wilder Theater at UCLA, March 9th through 16th at the Anthology Film Archives in New York. Go see it, so you'll have a spectacular time. Our recording engineer at KCRW in Santa Monica is Mario Diaz. The show is mixed by J.C. Swadek. It is edited, and the associate producer is Jenny Radelet. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.